Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Ruth Uzecki. Uzecki is both an award-winning filmmaker, her films have been shown at Sundance and other major festivals, but is also a Zen Buddhist priest and a best-selling author. Her most recent novel, A Tale for the Time Being, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle. Elizabeth Gilbert called it a beautifully interwoven novel about magic and loss and the incomprehensible threads that connect our lives. And Juno Diaz said, Uzecki is one of my favorite novelists, and here she is at her absolute best, bewitching, intelligent, hilarious, and heartbreaking, often on the same page. Uzecki's other novels are My Year of Meats and All Over Creation, which Michael Pollan called a smart and compelling novel about a world we don't realize we live in. Here's Ruth Uzecki in 2015 as part of Portland Arts and Lectures at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Wow. Hi, everybody. It's good to see you, sort of. I can sort of see you. It's just really, really, really wonderful to be here. And this is the most incredibly beautiful building I think I've ever spoken in. I feel very special, and I wish I had an instrument to play or something. You know, I feel words, you know, they're so awkward sometimes. Whereas music is truly sublime. So we'll just kind of coast off all of the music that's been played here and hope for the best, I guess. I always feel really happy when I come to Portland because Portland is a town of readers and eaters. You are my tribe. And I want to thank the Portland Arts and Lectures for bringing me here and for arranging this very, very full and wonderful week for me. You know, I have to confess that when Andrew emailed and invited me, you know, I thought, you know, awesome. Writer in residence in Portland. This should be a good gig. Kind of chill, you know. Kind of laid back. I mean, it's Portland, right? I can hang out in the literary arts suite at the Heathman Hotel, kick back, relax, maybe watch a little TV, get caught up on some reading. They've kept me running. In the past 3 days, I've visited 6 classes at Grand High School, where I just found out I talked to over 200 incredibly smart and really creative students, both in the Japanese immersion program and also in Dr. Dreyer's truly excellent film and literature classes. And I've taught 2 wonderful adult master classes in fiction, and tomorrow I'll teach another class in meditation and writing. I've read some amazing, great manuscripts and given interviews, and now I get to stand here and talk with all of you. So all in all, it's been a very busy week, and I see now that this whole image of Portland as a kind of laid-back slacker town is just a very cleverly constructed facade. And Portland is actually a city of type A overachievers who are trying to keep other type A overachievers from moving to Portland. So now I know. And maybe I'll move here too. You know, because when it comes to literary arts and programs like the Writers in the Schools, I am a type A overachiever too. And it's just been such a pleasure to be welcomed so warmly and enthusiastically to the Portland literary community and to be given a chance to participate so fully in it. And I really want to thank Andrew and Susan and everybody in the Portland Arts and Portland Literary Arts for making this possible. Really, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. And I also want to thank the Heathman Hotel for putting me up and creating such an author-friendly environment, which is kind of like a pet-friendly environment, only it's for authors. Actually, the Heathman is famous for this kind of specialty service. For example, they offer a pampered pet package for humans and their non-human companions, which is really kind of amazing. If you're the human, you get to choose from something called the Art of Sleep Luxury Bed Menu, featuring a choice of mattresses, including Tempur-Pedic European Pillow Top or European Feather Beds. If you're the non-human, you get to choose from the Bark of Sleep menu, which features a choice of memory foam, faux suede, or a bolster bed. Plus, you get a water bowl as a special keepsake inscribed with the Heathman logo. So that's pretty cool, right? Unfortunately, authors do not get an inscribed water bowl. At least, I don't think we do we? But we do get to stay in the literary suite. And I don't know many other hotels in the country that has a literary arts suite. Like, that's really Portland. And the suite is quite amazing. It's filled with plush leather couches and mirrors and glass bookcases with actual books inside them. Like real books with covers and pages that you can turn and read, you know? And they're good books, too. They're literary books, which, of course, makes sense because the selection is curated by the magnificent and venerable Powell's Bookstore. So it includes some of my favorite authors, like Lydia Davis and Jonathan Lethem and Margaret Atwood and Annie Proulx, books that I actually want to read. So there I was, about to settle into the plush leather couch with a volume of Lydia Davis's collected stories, when I decided to take a few pictures of the literary arts suite and text them to my husband. This is something I do when I'm on book tour. I text him abject pictures of myself in hotel rooms. And you can imagine my surprise when he texted me back and told me that the Heathman is a featured location in one of the most successful books in all of publishing history. You're thinking the Bible, right? No, you would be wrong. It's not the Bible, it's not Harry Potter, it's 50 Shades of Grey, which has sold over 100 million copies. And those were the sales figures from last February, before the movie came out. So, anyway, when I got the text, I put down the Lydia Davis and went online to do a little research. And I discovered that not only has the Heathman created a special 50 Shades of Grey cocktail, it has also devised a special themed packages, too. It's not the pampered pet package. That really is for dogs. Okay. No, they offer the Inner Goddess add-on package, okay? Which includes a chilled bottle of the Pinot Gris that was apparently the protagonists of the novel Anastasia Steele and Christian Grey drink. And better yet, they have something called the Charlie Tango No Limits package. Charlie Tango being the name of Christian Grey's helicopter, which includes dinner, wine, quote, roses for the ladies, and a helicopter tour of Portland. So, Portland, when you hear the choppers circling overhead, maybe it's not the riot police breaking up another march or an Occupy encampment. Maybe something else is going on. And I should mention, too, that both the Inner Goddess and the Charlie Tango No Limits packages also includes a special 50 Shades of Grey keepsake. Can you guess what that might be? It's not a doggy bowl. It's a necktie. A grey necktie. Now, I gather gray neckties play an important part in the novel, and since nobody in Portland wears neckties, gray or otherwise, the Heathman kindly provides one and lets you use it and even take it home with you. Aaron Mesh, a reporter for the Willamette Weekly, used Google Books to search the novel for all of the reference... Willamette, sorry. Did I get that wrong? I did, right? Thank you. You've got my back. He used Google Books to search the novel for all of the reference to the Heathman Hotel. And I was grateful to him for doing so because it meant I didn't have to. And although I was thinking of reading some of these passages out loud to you, in the end, that seemed like unnecessary punishment. So I have decided to spare you. You can go and Google those passages yourself in the privacy of your own homes. But I will say that after reading the passages in Aaron's very funny blog post, I have a slightly different feeling about the plush leather couch in my literary arts suite. Try as I may, I just can't quite get comfortable in it, even with that thick volume of Lydia Davis. However, I'm not complaining, and actually I've decided that I'm going to put the Heathman Hotel into my next novel, because clearly it worked for E.L. James. 100 million copies. Whatever works, right? Okay. Time to get serious. Time to stop fooling around. Okay. Tonight, I'd like to talk about A Tale for the Time Being and about some of the things that went into the writing of it. But I also want to talk about superpower. Do you know what superpower is? If you've read A Tale for the Time Being, you'll know, but don't worry. The good news is that even if you haven't read the book, you still have a superpower, and by the time you leave tonight, you'll know what it is and what to do with it. And I want to start, though, by talking about time, and about time being, and about being a time being. You know, what is a time being, exactly? And what does it mean to be one? The phrase first caught my attention back in 2002 when I was reading an essay by a 13th century Zen philosopher named Dogen Zenji, who wrote some very beautiful and poetic and very perplexing essays about time. And one of these essays was called Uji in Japanese. The Japanese character U means being or existence, and the character Ji means time. And this word has been translated into English in various ways, time being, being time, with and without the hyphen, some time, some moments, and even the theory of time. So you can see there's a wide range of interpretation. The translation I happen to be reading translated Uji as the time being, with the definite article and the hyphen. And this phrase kind of stuck in my mind. I think the reason it stuck is because it's a little bit unstable. Its meaning changes depending on how you inflect it. So, for example, if you put the emphasis on the second word, the time being, then it means temporarily or for now. In other words, the idiomatic meaning that we're accustomed to. But if you put the emphasis on the first word, the time being, then it suggests a being, like a human being or an alien being, an entity constructed out of time, kind of like the Time Lords in Doctor Who. Do you know Doctor Who? I'm a big Doctor Who fan. So, anyway, as I was reading this essay, every time I came across the phrase, I'd kind of stumble across it, sometimes reading it one way, for the time being, and sometimes the other way, for the time being. It felt somehow like this phrase was refusing to settle, like it had a will or a spirit of its own that was wanting to come to life, and I found that intriguing. Ideas are like this. Ideas are living things, and language is a living thing, too. And like a living thing, this time being took up residence in my mind. It burrowed into my brain and made itself at home, and it went to sleep. From time to time, it would wake up and yawn and rustle around, and I would wonder, what does it mean, this strange, unsettled, alive phrase? But then, before I could find an answer, it would go back to sleep again, And this continued for several years, until December of 2006, to be exact, when I woke up one morning and heard a voice in my head. It was the voice of a young Japanese schoolgirl who introduced herself and said, "Hi, my name is Nao, and I'm a time being. Do you know what a time being is? Well, if you give me a moment, I will tell you." So that was kind of funny, right? I mean, she was making a little dogen joke. And how many people do you know who can make dogen jokes? She was asking for a moment of my time to explain something about time. And she was also making a little pun because her name is Nao, N-A-O, which sounds a lot like now, N-O-W. So her words caught my attention, and I wrote them down, and I waited. And little by little, her story emerged. And I'll just read the first page of the novel so you can hear her voice the way I heard it. "Hi. My name is Nao, and I'm a time being. Do you know what a time being is? Well, if you give me a moment, I will tell you. A time being is someone who lives in time, and that means you and me and every one of us who is, or was, or ever will be. As for me, right now, I'm sitting in a French maid cafe in Akiba Electricity Town, listening to a sad chanson that's playing sometime in your past, which is also my present, writing this and wondering about you, somewhere in my future. And if you're reading this, then maybe by now you're wondering about me too. You wonder about me. I wonder about you. Who are you, and what are you doing? Are you in a New York subway car hanging from a strap or soaking in your hot tub in Sunnyvale? Are you sunbathing on a sandy beach in Phuket or having your toenails buffed in Abu Dhabi? Are you a male or a female or somewhere in between? Is your girlfriend cooking you a yummy dinner, or are you eating cold Chinese noodles from a box? Are you curled up with your back turned coldly towards your snoring wife, or are you eagerly waiting for your beautiful lover to finish his bath so you can make passionate love to him? Do you have a cat? And is she sitting on your lap? Does her forehead smell like cedar trees and fresh, sweet air? Actually, it doesn't matter very much, because by the time you read this, everything will be different, and you will be nowhere in particular, flipping idly through the pages of this book, which happens to be the diary of my last days on Earth, wondering if you should keep on reading. And if you decide not to read anymore, hey, no problem, because you're not the one I was waiting for anyway. But if you do decide to read on, then guess what? You're my kind of time being, and together, we'll make magic." Thank you. Thank you. So this was all very promising and exciting. Novels often come to me as voices, and as soon as I heard Nao's voice, I knew certain things about her. I knew that she was a junior high school student sitting in this maid cafe in Tokyo, writing in some kind of diary. I sensed that she was troubled, and possibly even suicidal. But she also had an attitude and a quirky sense of humor, which seemed to point to some kind of inner source of strength. I knew that she was writing in English, which was odd, because why would a Japanese schoolgirl be writing in English? And it was clear that she was writing to someone, which was also odd, because normally we don't write diaries for other people to read. But Nao definitely had a reader in mind. She had all the confidence of a young writer casting her words out into the world, certain that someone would be there to receive them, and knowing that when that happened, something magical would occur. The problem was that Nao didn't know who her reader would be, and so neither did I. So it was my job then, as a novelist, to figure this out. Who is Nao's reader? And this took a long time. It took 5 years. 5 years is a very long time. I would even say that it's an achingly long time for an impatient novelist whose last book had been published almost a decade earlier. But during that achingly long time, little by little, Nao's story emerged. It turned out that her father was a computer interface designer who had been headhunted by a gaming startup in Silicon Valley, so Nao had grown up in Sunnyvale, California. When she was 14, her father lost his job through mysterious circumstances, and the family was forced to move back to Tokyo. Nao's father became a recluse, spending his days folding elaborate origami insects to stave off thoughts of suicide. Nao's mother was supporting the family, and Nao was put into a Japanese junior high school, where she becomes the target of bullying so terrible she feels she has no choice but to commit suicide too. But before she ends her life, she's determined to do one last act of redemption, to tell the fascinating life story of her 104-year-old great-grandmother, Old Jiko, who is a Zen Buddhist nun. And I should mention here that Old Jiko isn't just any 104-year-old Zen Buddhist nun. She's a 104-year-old anarchist feminist Zen Buddhist nun. Old Jiko is Nao's only friend and really the only reliable adult she knows. So Nao sets out to write down Old Jiko's fascinating life story in the pages of her diary, but of course, being a 16-year-old, she finds her own life far more interesting, and she keeps getting distracted. So this was all well and good, but I still couldn't figure out the identity of Nao's reader, and time was passing. And here, too, I have to admit that actually I'd been thinking about time long before Nao's voice came to me. My interest in time started back in 1998, the year my father died. And there's nothing like the death of a parent or a loved one to make you wake up to the urgency of time passing. And too, if you recall, we were all thinking about time back then because we were standing on the cusp of a new millennium, which seemed like such a significant event on one hand, and at the same time, utterly arbitrary and meaningless. On one hand, it felt very special to be alive to witness the turn of a millennium because not many of us human time beings get to do this. You know, redwood trees are more likely to witness the turn of a millennium than we are, although, of course, they wouldn't know it. They're trees. They don't care. But for some reason, we do care, and because we're such short-lived time beings, the turn of the millennium felt pretty special. And we were all making a big fuss about it. Do you remember all of those apocalyptic millennial predictions about the end of the world that were flying around back then? That thankfully they proved false, or at least we think they did. And then there was the whole Y2K scare. Do you remember that? The millennium bug, which was going to cause all of the computers in the world to shut down, along with all the banks and the utilities and the governments, so that at the end of December 1999, people were frantically stockpiling food and bottled water and flashlights and batteries, waiting for this big event, and then nothing. And then a year later, it was 2001, an iconic year because of the Kubrick film. 2001, A Space Odyssey came out in 1968 when I was 12 years old, and I saw it in a theater because back then we didn't have Netflix. How did we ever survive? That film represented a distant future so far away it was unimaginable. 2001 seemed like the end of time, or at least it did to me at 12. And yet, suddenly, here we were, in 2001. And the months passed, and the world was still here, and the sun rose on the bright blue morning of September 11th.
You're listening to a talk by Ruth Ozeki. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and more with Ozeki is coming up.
Wasn't the end of the world, but there were moments when it felt like it might be. I was in Wisconsin at the time. I'd gone there to give a talk at the university, and I remember watching those planes crashing into the twin towers of the World Trade Center over and over again, and the towers falling over and over again, and then renting a car and driving all the way home across the continent to the island in British Columbia so I could be with my mother, who was living with us at the time. And if you've read A Tale for the Time Being, this story might sound familiar to you. And here is where another element of the novel kind of fell into place. In the wake of 9/11, many pundits were comparing the terrorist attack to the Japanese kamikaze bombings during World War II. And right around this time, a book called Kamikaze, Cherry Blossoms, and Nationalisms by Emiko Onuki Tierney was published. I stumbled across it because the author, an anthropologist at the University of Wisconsin, had written an op-ed piece explaining why the comparison between the 9/11 terrorists and the kamikaze pilots was flawed. And this got me interested. Her book was an analysis of letters and diaries of kamikaze pilots, beautiful, poetic, learned writing, which revealed that these pilots were not the fundamentalist imperialist fanatics that history had painted them to be. On the contrary, most of them were college students, sensitive, bright, intellectual, poets and philosophers, Marxists and pacifists, who'd been conscripted and trained to fly suicide missions in support of a war they opposed to defend their country, which they loved. Their writing detailed their agonizing struggle to make sense of their lives in the face of certain death, and I found this poignant and moving. I grew up in the shadow of World War II, but these were stories that I had never heard before. These young men were time beings who had dropped out of time, leaving holes and gaps in the historical record. I felt haunted by their absence, and a character, Haruki, was born from this. From 2001 to 2006, I started two or three different novels about this young philosophy student pilot, but none of them worked, and so I abandoned them. But I kept hoping that at some point I would find a way to tell his story. And to tell you the truth, my writing wasn't going very well at this point. I was in a bit of a funk during those first years of the millennium. I kept starting and discarding novels, and in desperation, I even tried writing a memoir. My mother had Alzheimer's, and I was taking care of her during the last years of her life. She was almost 90 by then, an ancient time being who was traveling backwards in time. Although she was very alive and present in each moment, she was losing her short-term memory, and she couldn't remember things that had happened a few days or weeks or months or even minutes earlier. Little by little, her recent memories were dissolving until only the old ones remained, memories of her childhood growing up in Hawaii, beautifully preserved like insects in amber. She was another time being dropping out of time, and I thought that in my memoir I could write about this, about taking care of her, about her stories, about her fascinating life. So all of this was interesting and sad and frightening and frustrating. I'd had a casual meditation practice for quite some time, but towards the end of my mother's life, I started taking my Zen practice very seriously. And this was what led me to read Dogen's essay, Uji, or The Time Being. And you can see how all of these random elements, the deaths of my parents, Y2K, 9/11, the Kamikaze Diaries, Dogen, all sort of came together in my mind. You might remember that in the novel, I talk about the great garbage patches spinning around in the oceanic gyres. That's how my mind feels most of the time. Like a mental gyre, with this great, enormous garbage patch of information spinning around inside it, made up of all of the debris and detritus of my life. And from this garbage patch of my mind, Now's voice emerged, calling out for someone to listen, to pick up her diary and read it. Now, earlier I mentioned those five achingly long years I spent searching for Now's unknown reader. It was a fascinating and often frustrating process, kind of like casting an actor for a role in a film or a play. I'd think of a character and invite him into the fictional world. I'd arrange for him to find the diary. He'd start to read it and to react. Now would respond And little by little, the fictional world would start to grow, getting all round and plump and promising. And then, one morning, maybe 50, 100 pages in, I'd open up the manuscript and find that the world had just gone flat, like a burst balloon. And I'd realize then that I'd found the wrong reader, and so I'd usher him out, and after a suitable period of grieving, I'd think of another reader, maybe a woman this time, and invite her into the fictional world and start the whole thing all over again. I repeated this process about 4 or 5 times in as many years, and wrote 4 or 5 different versions of the book, each with a different character cast in the role of the reader. Some were young, some were old, some were male, some were female, some were in between. And each time, with each reader, Now's story would get a little longer. And for those of you who've read the book, you can see why the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics would hold such an appeal for me. Finally, at the beginning of 2011, I managed to finish a draft. It wasn't a very good draft. It was a completely different book than the one out in the world now. It had a very different reader and a very different plot and all sorts of problems which I didn't know how to fix. I gave it to my agent, who agreed that it had problems. And we were just about to submit it to my editor, hoping that she could help sort them out, when on March 11th, the Tohoku earthquake and tsunami hit Japan. I spent the next few days watching those horrifying images of waves obliterating towns and villages along the coastline and washing them out to sea. I have friends and family in Tokyo and in Sendai, and so, of course, my first concern was for them. But when the meltdown at Fukushima nuclear reactor occurred, my worry turned global. The world was now a different place. Japan was a different place. And it hit me then that the novel that I'd written was no longer relevant. Certain catastrophic events cause a rift in time, dividing time into before and after. I'd written a pre-earthquake, pre-tsunami, pre-Fukushima book, and we were now living in a post-earthquake, post-tsunami, post-Fukushima world. So I couldn't go forward with the book, and I asked my agent to return the manuscript, and I really thought that that was the end of it. But Now's voice just kept coming back to me and wouldn't leave me alone. I talked it over with my husband, Oliver, and he made a suggestion. He pointed out that the devastating reality of the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear meltdown had broken the world, and it had certainly broken the fictional world of my book, too. And since that was the case, the only appropriate response was to acknowledge the brokenness and to allow the fiction to stay broken. And the way to do this was to step into the fictional world myself as a, quote, real person, and allow the reality to penetrate the fictional world of the novel. Now's reader had to be me, and the earthquake and tsunami and nuclear meltdown, these awful, catastrophic, random, but very real factors, had to become part of the story. I thought about this and realized that Oliver was right. But then I pointed out that if I were going to be in the book, then he would have to be in the book too. Thankfully, he agreed. He said that he thought it would be an interesting thought experiment. So finally, more than a decade since I'd started thinking and obsessing about time, and more than 5 years since Now's voice came to me, A Tale for the Time Being was ready to be written. I unzipped the manuscript and threw about 2/3 of it away and started over again. In this final version, Now's diary washes up on the beach on the far side of the Pacific Ocean on a remote island off the coast of Canada, where it's discovered by a reader, the perfect reader, as it turns out, whose name is Ruth. Ruth assumes that the diary is part of the debris field that got washed out to sea after the 2011 Japanese earthquake and tsunami. She starts to read Now's diary and becomes obsessed with the girl's life, determined to discover her fate. It took an achingly long time, but I think it illustrates an important point, that novels are time beings too. They take the time they take. So I'd like to shift gears now and talk about time in a more general sense. The years that I spent studying and sitting with Dogen's teaching on time got me thinking about the way that we understand and misunderstand time in our contemporary culture. I think it's safe to say that most of us feel like we're living pretty busy lives, right? Is that true? We never seem to have enough time to answer all of our email or get all of the things done on our to-do lists. We're always behind. I mean, I might be wrong about this. Maybe some of you feel like you have too much time on your hands. Maybe you're bored. I hope not, but maybe that's the case. But either way, we feel like we're somehow out of step with time, or at least in a contentious relationship with time. And I think this comes from our limited understanding of time, which is in itself a function of the times in which we live. Now, this sounds a lot more confusing than it is, so bear with me. We are materialists living in a post-Enlightenment, rationalist, empiricist, secular, scientific, technological, consumer culture. These values and beliefs together form the lens through which we see the world and which determines how we experience our lives. So when we look at time through this rationalist, materialist lens, we naturally experience it as something material too. Time is a quantifiable and limited commodity, a finite resource, and something that we consume. And our language reflects this. Keeping time, wasting time, spending time, running out of time, killing time, saving time, taking, gaining, losing, etc. This materialist view of time as a limited commodity seems to be an outgrowth of our Judeo-Christian view of time as linear, beginning with God's creation and ending with the end of the world. But of course, linear time is only one way of understanding time, and it seems important to remember that there are other ways of understanding and experiencing time too. You know, as I'm sure you know, many cultures, Mayan, Native American, Greek, Hindu, early Buddhist, understood time as cyclical, these great temporal gyres that, like the circle of the seasons, are endlessly replenishing and renewing. The ancient Greeks had two different words for time, Chronos and Kairos. Chronos refers to quantifiable chronological time. Kairos refers to qualitative or metaphysical time, literally the right or supreme or opportune moment in which something or everything occurs, more akin to our notion of timeliness. Dogen Zenji had a wonderfully all-inclusive view of time as being, as existence itself, which was not dissimilar to what Martin Heidegger described 700 years later in Sein und Zeit, being and time. The way we view time, or map time, determines the way we see it. But in the end, it's metaphorical, arbitrary, and even imaginary. All that exists, all that we can ever know, is the present moment. The past doesn't exist. If it exists, then where is it? The same holds true for the future. Where is it? It's nowhere. It exists only in our minds. Our minds are time travelers, continually spinning off into some imaginary past or future, while our bodies are fixed in a particular moment in time and space. So our bodies and minds are often at odds with each other. We do one thing with our bodies, but in our minds we're someplace else entirely, telling ourselves stories about the past or the future, worrying about an upcoming deadline or an email that we sent to our boss or an argument we had with a boyfriend or girlfriend or spouse or what we want for dinner. Our bodies and minds are rarely together in the present moment at the same time, and this skews the alignment between being and time and causes all sorts of suffering, which is what makes us humans such anxious and unsettled time beings. Unlike cats, for example. I suspect this is an experience that most cats do not have, at least not to the extent that we do. But, of course, I may be wrong about this too. Anyway, the claim that I'm making, that the way we view or map time determines the way we experience it, and in the end, it's all in our minds, this is kind of an abstract claim. So let me give you an example. You know, because we're a progress-driven culture, we think of the past as existing somewhere behind us, and therefore we are making progress into the future, which lies ahead, right? But not everyone uses this same mental map. The Aymara tribe in Peru, and I think this might be true for the ancient Chinese as well, view the past as being in front of us. Okay? Why? Well, because we can see it. We know what happened in the past. It's right here. You know your dead ancestors who have gone before you, and they're always with you, and they're leading the way. But the future is unknown, so it's back there, behind us, right? In a place that we can't yet see. It's like, what's that? Right? Oh, it's just my future creeping up on me. Our future is always trailing behind us. So how we experience, our experience of time is only one of many, and one that's limited by the lens of our times. Our post-Enlightenment, rationalist, materialist, et cetera, lens renders time as a quantifiable, linear, and limited commodity, and so that's how we experience it. The clock is ticking, like sands through the hourglass. These are the days of our lives. I used to be a filmmaker, and so this metaphor of a lens is one that works for me. Photographers will, of course, relate to this too. Lenses distort our perception of space the way clocks distort our perception of time. If you look at the world through a telephoto lens, for example, the lens shortens the distance between you and the object you're looking at, and it narrows your visual field and makes everything look taller and slimmer. A wide-angle lens expands your visual field but makes everything look far away and wider. A fisheye lens gives you the widest visual field, but it makes objects round and lines appear curved. So if you're born with a fisheye lens attached to your face, and you've only ever viewed the world through that lens, you might imagine that the world is spherical and people are round and short. You would have no way of knowing anything else because lenses are clear and transparent and you can't see them. You can only see their effects. I think this is analogous to what happens to our perception of time. Our watches and timers and clocks and calendars and schedules, our time management systems and our obsession with efficiency and speed have distorted our experience of time and of being. But since the lens is largely invisible, we mistake what we see for reality. Here's another example of the way that perception can change our experience of time. And this one is a kind of thought experiment proposed by Dogen Zenji back in 1250-something. Dogen was the founder of the Soto Zen lineage, and I think of him as a kind of pre-modern postmodernist, if such a thing is possible, because of the way that he deconstructs time and narrative and our notions of being. The purpose of his thought experiment is to exhort us, actually he's exhorting his young monks, but we can pretend that's us, to stay committed to a path of awakening. And in his instruction, he performs a kind of rhetorical sleight of hand to illustrate the relationship between time and action. He takes time and radically expands it by telling us that a single day is actually comprised of 6,400,099,980 moments. So, in the time it takes to snap your finger, 65 moments have passed. And then he tells us that every single one of those moments is a precious opportunity to reestablish our will and choose action that will be beneficial to our karma. Even in the snap of a finger, we have 65 opportunities to wake up. So, again, as a filmmaker, I think this is cool because it's kind of like a slow motion special effect. You know, when you're shooting film and you want to slow down an action, you actually have to increase the rate of film moving through the camera. So more frames pass across the shutter at a faster speed. And then when it's projected back at normal speed, the image appears to be moving in slow motion. I think that's what Dogen is doing. He's performing a kind of conceptual slow motion special effect on our experience of time passing 650 years before motion picture technology was invented. And I find this view of time, his view of time, to be quite astonishing. It's so expansive and generous. It means that there's always enough time if you just slow down. If you just slow down and take your time, you will have plenty of opportunities to choose to do something beneficial, to take a walk, for example, or to help someone out of a jam, or to be kind instead of impatient. So My point here is that there are many ways of experiencing time, and our modern way may not be the best or the healthiest for us as time beings. I think we've fallen out of sync with time. We've forgotten how to experience time as being. And as a result, we're suffering from a kind of temporal dysfunction, a distemporality, which is a result of our misperception of time as a quantifiable commodity. From time to time, the lens slips or loses focus, and we get a sense that something is amiss. We feel exhausted or overwhelmed, and feel, too, a sense that there must be something more to life. But most of the time, we just go along with the program. And in fact, we do have ways of stepping out of that rat race and into different time streams. We have ways of shifting from chronos to kairos, from quantitative to qualitative time. Art, literature, music, philosophy, religion, ritual, all of these provide more expansive and embodied ways of being in time. When you read a great book, or look at a painting, or listen to a symphony, or take part in a communal ritual of some kind, you're participating in time in a different way. And needless to say, the same holds true if you make art, or write poems, or play music. And deep concentration and meditation are similar. In fact, when you meditate, being in time is all that you're doing. That's what meditation is, just sitting still and fully experiencing what it is to be in time, to be a time being. Which brings us back to A Tale for the Time Being and to your superpower. Okay, so old Jiko, the 104-year-old anarchist, feminist, Zen Buddhist nun, knows that her great-granddaughter is being bullied in school, and she decides that now needs some way of coping with her feelings of sadness and anger and fear. She needs some power, some true power, like a superpower. But of course, old Jiko doesn't speak English very well, so she pronounces it more like superpower. Actually, she pronounces it more like superpower. And what she's talking about is the power of mindfulness meditation. And this is what she teaches now, how to sit zazen. So, what is meditation and why is it a superpower? Well, it sounds so simple, and it is simple. It's just taking that little backward step out of the mad forward rush of everyday life and sitting still and being in time. Just this. This is Dogen Zenji's teaching of meditation too. The point isn't to achieve some kind of blissed out transcendental state. I mean, that might happen, and it's nice if it does, but that's not the point. It's much more ordinary than that. We're simply training ourselves to be awake and present now, so that we can fully experience the feeling of being alive, in time, in a minute and granular way. Now, of course, most of the time when we meditate, we are not present in the present moment. We get sucked back into the past events, memories, regrets. I should have said this, should have done that, if only. Or we project into the future, plans, worries, and anxieties. I need to do this, I need to buy this, I have to remember something. And so we fall out of time. But when that happens, of course, it's not a problem, because minds are meant to think. And so when they do, it's simply an opportunity to notice and to come back to the breath. And in fact, we often talk about meditation as a practice of return. You notice your mind spinning off, and then, without judging, you just bring it back again and again to your breath, to yourself, and to your being. The reason old Jiko calls this a superpower is because when you practice like this over time, you develop a powerful capacity for patience, which is an undervalued virtue in our hyperactive consumer culture, and crucially important for the future of the planet and everyone on it, and not just for achingly slow writers like me. You also develop the powerful ability to listen and to pay attention to those quiet little voices that are alive inside us, whispering and shuffling around. If you learn to listen and really pay attention, you'll catch what they say. If you're not listening, if you're checking your email or binge-watching Game of Thrones, that would be me, the voices will just give up and go to sleep again. They don't really care one way or the other. And finally, you develop a kind of a powerful kind of faith and confidence in yourself, knowing that you can sit quietly with your mind and your feelings, even the harsh or difficult ones, without resisting or being derailed by them, so that when the time comes, you can respond to others and to the world with more clarity and kindness and compassion. So, self-confidence, faith, patience, the ability to listen to your intuition and to pay attention, these are some of the rewards of old Jiko's superpower. And I think you'll agree that everyone can benefit from them. It's a simple practice and one that allows us to come home to ourselves so we can fully be the time beings that we are. I think it's high time that we wrap this up. And I just want to thank you for spending a few of your very precious moments with me today. Thank you.
That was best-selling novelist Ruth Ozeki speaking in Portland in 2015. You've been listening to Literary Arts, The Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, and The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. I hope you can join us next time. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. We have all our talks online, and you can browse through them at literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces The Archive Project for radio. Thanks for joining us.